Welcome back to page 12 and 13. We've got Matthew's genealogy here, and it looks like it's going to be a doozy because, as you see, there's a lot of paragraph text on one side of the page, and then there's just a blank page on the other. Ooh. So, yes, there's a lot to write here, but at the same time, there's just a lot of noticing to happen here in this genealogy. This is how Matthew opens his gospel, okay? These are the first couple of paragraphs, and we just explored that Matthew is a Jewish, kind of focused author who's writing to the Jews to try to convince them that Jesus is actually the Messiah that fulfills all the prophecies, right? So he starts right out the gate in his genealogy by proving that. This isn't just like, him dotting his I's and crossing his T's and saying, "Hey, I'm just going to give you the backstory of who this guy is." He's actually doing something strategic here. He's building in an apologetics for the Virgin Mary through the genealogy. Okay, let me kind of break it apart for you. But first is just a couple of kind of 10,000 foot view facts. His genealogy is not comprehensive. Okay, the Book of Chronicles includes a lot of genealogies. As a matter of fact, genealogies are they happen all throughout the Old Testament. It's not like he's coming up with this idea of listing names. Luke also has a genealogy in chapter 3. It's important to establish the family line of people because they have been tracking the bloodline all throughout the Old Testament. So the genealogy does establish that Jesus is in the bloodline from Adam and Eve. But it's also just like they do the genealogies all throughout the Old Testament. Now, this one is not comprehensive. The Book of Chronicles includes more people that Matthew cuts out. Matthew is trying to spell out the word David through his use of the number 14. Okay, check this out. Hebrew has, I guess, no numbers, or rather, the numbers and the letters are in the same alphabet. So if you take certain letters in a row, they can also be a numeric value. Okay. So the name David is equivalent to the number 14. Okay. DVD. I guess you add up DVD, the numbers of D, V, and D, and you get the number 14. Okay. So he uses 14 generations three times. If you notice in his genealogy, I have it here on the page in three different kind of paragraphs. And then, of course, at the bottom, there's like a little epilogue. The three paragraphs, starting with the one with from Abraham to King David, that's 14 generations. So it spells David. From David to the deportation to Babylon, that second paragraph, that's 14 generations. Again, 14 meaning David. And then that third paragraph, deportation to Mary, who bore Jesus, again, 14 generations. So a Jew reading this wouldn't just read the names and say, "Yeah, I recognize the names of my ancestors. Cool, he's doing a history lesson." They would actually see, "Huh, he's saying David, David, David." And when you say something three times, it's a way in the Hebrew language of saying like the best, the most. It's like holy, holy, holy. It means the holiest. It's the same as like the Song of Songs. It means the best song, the greatest song. So he's saying David, David, David. He's saying Jesus is the Davidest David. Okay? He is the one who is going to fulfill David's covenant. David's covenant is the weird one in the Old Testament. It's not really about David, it's about his son who will reign forever, who will be a son of God, who will sit on the throne, who will build the temple, like all these things that Jesus ultimately is going to do. So if you just open this up as a Jew reader, you're already kind of thinking, okay, Matthew is trying to tell me Jesus is the son of David. But there's more. There is this big prophecy in the Old Testament that Isaiah gives to King Ahaz about a virgin birth. Okay, behold, the virgin will bear a son, and they call his name Jesus. So this virgin birth is what Matthew is about to explain. After his genealogy, he goes straight into the infancy narratives. So he explains Mary and the virgin birth and the Annunciation. So he's setting up the genealogy kind of like as a runway to actually talk about Mary, the virgin birth. Okay? He's trying to show Jesus' divine pedigree and how he fulfills all of the prophets. But it's kind of a startling and a little bit of a scandalous thing to say, Mary was found pregnant, engaged to Joseph, technically married to Joseph, and was found pregnant with Jesus before they lived together. So Mary looks like she's unfaithful. Mary looks like she deserves stoning because she cheated on her husband. And this is going to be the mother. This is going to be the mother of the Savior. This is going to be the Savior comes from her. So Matthew is noticing that this is going to be startling to people, and he's trying to make the strong connection that, first, don't rule out Mary. Don't judge her, because she actually is the mother of God. And second, she is fulfilling this prophecy that the virgin will conceive and bear. He is a virgin. She didn't cheat on Joseph. She was not unfaithful to him. So Matthew's kind of defending Mary. And he does this by putting four women in the genealogy strategically. Okay? Most genealogies don't include women. There is no need in the sense that it's the bloodline is passed through the father, through the man. And so it's rare, and it's even rare in Matthew's genealogy. He doesn't include all the wives' names, but just four women. And each of these four women he includes before Solomon. Solomon was a huge deal, okay? They thought Solomon was going to be the savior. Solomon's the one who built the temple. He's the one who actually reigned when all 12 tribes were united. He's like kind of the big deal. He had the wisdom poetry. He had a good era. Until, of course, he, you know, messed everything up and the divided kingdom happened because of him. But before that, Solomon was amazing. And he kind of lives in Jewish memory as like the king, the best king, okay? Solomon. So Matthew, in his genealogy, places four women pre-Solomon in the genealogy. Matthew shows that Solomon and Jesus, of course, share a genealogy. So any ancestor of Solomon's is an ancestor of Jesus's. But he's saying, if you can accept that these four women are where Solomon came from, and you still see Solomon as this amazing, fantastic, the best, the Jewish king, then you have to accept the scandalous, in quotes, woman who is in Jesus's genealogy too, okay? Let's take a look at this a little bit closer. The four women that he chooses to include are Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba, who's called the wife of Uriah, okay? If you can find these guys in the paragraph, circle them. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and the wife of Uriah, whose name is Bathsheba. Okay, Tamar, if you know your Old Testament, she is the one who dressed up as a prostitute to sleep with and trick her father-in-law, and she bore incestuous twins, okay? That's how she got herself into the bloodline. So that's Tamar. Rahab was a prostitute from the city of Jericho who exchanged her safety and God sparing her and her family's life for passage from the spies in the desert into Jericho. So she was a prostitute who kind of converted and came into the Jews. Ruth was a Moabite. Moabites were formed from an incestuous relationship. Again, all this incest between Lot, Abraham's nephew. And so you're not supposed to touch the Moabites. In the book of Leviticus, it's like Moabites are off limits. Yet Ruth was married to an Israelite man, widowed, cared so compassionately for her mother-in-law that Boaz, who was in the bloodline, actually married her. So Ruth is kind of like a Moabite in the bloodline. And then Bathsheba, who's named the wife of Uriah because she was a married woman, a wife of somebody else who King David called in to have adultery with her because he lusted after her and he had her husband killed to cover up what he'd done. So in four little names here, Matthew's reminding the Jewish people, remember Tamar, remember Rahab, remember Ruth, remember Uriah's wife? All of those people are accepted into Solomon's, you know, bloodline. But Mary, you're going to really point a finger at Mary and say, oh, Jesus, the Savior can't have come from that woman. Like, really? So he's setting up, see, this like apologetics strategy for Mary. He front loads the genealogy with questionable women to make the Mary's the virgin and had Jesus to make that kind of blow a little easier to take. If you can't accept the Savior Jesus because of the questionable parts of his birth, you can't accept Solomon. You can't accept David. Look at his line. Look at his origins. And you say that they're really qualified kings, but you say that Jesus is not a qualified king. So do you see what Matthew's doing? He's very, very, very clever, very strategic. So he uses the David, 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 and then he uses the four women in the genealogy to really make a point here. Another note, I think I said this in the other page, but Luke goes back in his genealogy all the way to Adam because he's writing to Gentiles and he's emphasizing like the solidarity of Jesus to all mankind. And it's 77 generations going back from Jesus to Adam. Okay. But Matthew does not. Matthew goes just back to Abraham and he starts there because that's really the focus of the Jewish people. Now, I also think when we're on this page, it's fun to just run through the stories of these people. I actually am not going to do that because this is the New Testament course. I'm assuming actually that you've read the Old Testament course, but what would be fun if you've done the Old Testament course, if you know your Old Testament, is actually to go through and to see the names. I bolded all the ones that you should already recognize and know from the Old Testament course, but you should know something about each one of these stories, which is crazy. You actually know a little bit about each of these guys. it's not just a list of names anymore. Now it's history. It's living history. You're like, oh, yes, I know all this. This is, the Old Testament is the story of the genealogy of Jesus. And it's here. I think it's cool. This is read on generally on Easter, not Easter, sorry, Christmas Eve. So it's kind of like preparing you to receive Jesus. Remember where we've been, Advent, remember where we've been. And now here is the Messiah, kind of. He doesn't come alone. He comes on the shoulders of and within the family that he's chosen. There's also a nice lens here that we'll talk about later. This, what's it called? Moral lens that Jesus has a messy family too. You are not disqualified from God's kingdom. If your family is a mess and you feel like I came from generations of whatever, like Jesus did too. He had messy people in his bloodline and he accepted them and he chose his bloodline. You know what I'm saying? So anyways, I would pause here if you want and just go circle each of the names that you know, write little notes in the margins and say, oh, this was, you know, Joseph, he was sold into slavery. He's the one who saved people from the famine. Oh, this is, you know, this guy, whatever. But while we're here on this page as well, I also have a note about Luke's genealogy, just because where else would I put it besides the Matthew's genealogy page? Okay, so Luke's genealogy differs from Matthew's slightly, but that shouldn't put us in a tizzy. That's okay. It's common, actually, for different books of the Bible to slightly disagree on the genealogy because names were different in different, how do I say this best? The name written in a genealogy isn't necessarily the name of the person. Okay, sometimes there are nicknames, different names people go by, but genealogies could either follow the legal or the biological descent of the person, or both. So there's this whole concept of the adoption, okay? If in Israelite law, if a wife's husband dies, her brother is supposed to marry her and take her children. And so the father of the children could either be called the dead husband or the uncle, technically, who has now become their father. So the adoption of sons legally by uncles or others, that's put into the genealogy. We can see this in a non-biblical example because this was just like how the ancient world kind of worked. Augustus Caesar, he had three fathers. He had the biological Gaius Octavius, his stepfather Lucius Marcus Philippus, and his uncle Julius Caesar, who adopted him as his heir. So Roman law lists him as Julius's son, but he isn't his son. He's his uncle. He's got two other technical fathers before them. So genealogies kind of can get messy in that way. We can't get so fixed on like, what is really, you know, why do we call St. Anne and St. Joachim those names when it says Jacob and Healy? Okay, it's okay just to, at least for our purposes, have a Bible basic course to say the church has kind of got a handle on it. It's okay. It's not troubling. Mary is an only child. A working theory is that her father adopted Joseph into his genealogy, which is common. That might be a reason that Joseph has like the two different father names in the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Matthew. He's got different names for his father. Okay, hopefully that all made sense. And you can see how very, very attention to detail Matthew is here at the beginning. And we're going to get into the next page.